Hello, everybody. Before we dive into today's episode, we are brought to you by Routine. When we sleep, we lose between a pound and a half of water, mostly from expelling vapors and sweating. Routine came up with a product called Morning Routine. It's a single-serve packet that contains half an organic lemon, 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, Himalayan sea salt, all 6 essential electrolytes, and no sugar. I just tear one of these open, dump it into my water first thing in the morning, and honestly, I feel so much more hydrated when I use it. Highly recommend you trying Morning Routine to just give you a hydration boost to your day first thing in the morning before you grab your cup of coffee. If you want to try Morning Routine, go to yourroutine.com and use code ShaneWhite30 at checkout. You'll receive 30% off your first order. Today, we're also brought to you by Elite Sweets. Elite Sweets is redefining the way we think about sweets with their Elite Donut. The Elite Donut is a better-for-you donut that is packed with 13 grams of protein, gluten-free, keto-friendly, and most importantly, in my opinion, contains only 1 gram of sugar. So if you want a sweet, but you don't want to ruin your macros, don't want to ruin your diet, grab yourself an Elite Donut. Again, there's 13 grams of protein, so they're a great protein snack. I love these things, especially when I'm just craving something sweet. It's something that I would probably ruin my diet on, but I grab an Elite Donut instead, get 13 grams of protein. They also have a new flavor, maple, they just launched, and they're also shelf stable now. So check. They're easy to store in your pantry, take them with you on the go. They're fantastic. I love them. You can get yours today at EliteDonut.com or on Amazon. Either way, if you use code ShaneWhite30, you'll get 30% off your order. We're also brought to you by NeuroRoast today. Today's episode is brought to you by NeuroRoast, a company that's dedicated to helping you optimize your brain function and overall well-being. NeuroRoast's flagship product is their premium mushroom coffee, which is made with an organic single-origin coffee and their signature blend of 5 different functional mushrooms, cordyceps, lion's mane, reishi, turkey tail, and chaga. Mushroom coffee is a new and exciting way to supercharge your day. Unlike regular coffee, which can cause jitters and crashes, mushroom coffee provides a more balanced and sustained energy boost, allowing you to stay focused and productive throughout the day. And with NeuroRoast ground and instant coffee options, you can enjoy the benefits of mushroom coffee wherever and whenever you need it. And here's some great news for my listeners today. NeuroRoast is offering an exclusive discount code just for you. If you use code ShaneWhite, and that's just Shane White, one word, during checkout at NeuroRoast.com, you'll get 30% off your order of NeuroRoast mushroom coffee. So whether you choose the ground or instant option, the Shane White 30 discount code will work for 30% off. All right, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Shane White Show. I am pumped today. This is an exciting one. My homie, Mike Scavuzzo, on the podcast. Mike, how are you, buddy?
No complaints, man. Thank you so much for having me as a listener. It's fun to be on here. I think this is my first podcast, so this will be an exciting one for the both of us.
Oh, I'm fired up. That's awesome. We were joking before we hit record. You have quite the setup. So if anyone's watching this episode, we can watch it now. Mike's got like the professional camera. It's right at face level. He's got the microphone. I'm like, this is good. Maybe I need to adopt this. I send my guests this whole setup that you got. It might be the move.
You know, with being in sales and having that remote setup, I think it's key and crucial to have a solid professional setting just to come through a little clearer, because I know sometimes computer cameras are not the best.
I do think it actually does level up like the way you look to clients. It's funny. I've done the same, and then some days I'm just on my laptop, and there's a big difference between the two.
Yeah. Covers up the imperfections on the computer camera. This one just puts a little more focus.
Exactly. Well, for everyone listening who doesn't know who you are, would you mind giving everyone just a little bit of a background and intro into yourself? And for everyone who's listening, me and Mike have known each other for a long time. I met Mike back in 2017, funny enough. Yeah. It wasn't that long. When I joined RX Bar, Mike was there. He'd been there a little bit when I joined. So that's back in the OG RX days. Before we sold the house. So
I know days I look back fondly too, but yeah, my background has been always in CPG. I was lucky to kind of fall into the industry while I was at school. I went to Michigan State for an undergrad degree in marketing, and thought I was going to go the agency route and do more of the creative end of marketing. But I was fortunate to land an internship with the Big K Kellogg in Battle Creek. So that was really my first entrance into, you know, CPG and specifically category management. So I supported their ready to eat cereal and frozen food categories. And 3 days a week, my senior year would drive down to Battle Creek and work there. And, you know, it was just an incredible experience to get that training and that kind of exposure that young in the career. So it was there through my senior year. And then after graduation, went to Whirlpool for about a year and a half. Really great company. Obviously, another Michigan, Southwest Michigan company in appliances.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Benton Harbor. You know, appliances just didn't do it for me. I look back on what I was doing with food and Kellogg and just absolutely loved it. I wanted to get back into that space. So was able to find an opportunity with Red Bull down in their Dallas office for their business unit down in what they called Mountain South at the time. And really just supported a sales team from a category analyst role. So, you know, C stores, grocery, small chains, big chains. A lot of what I was doing was going in with my sales counterparts and giving more of a category approach instead of a, you know, hard sales approach to, you know, why we should push some of these Red Bull initiatives and why it would be better for the category at large. So did that, was elevated into a category development manager role, which essentially is, you know, you're doing the same type of work, but now you're on, you know, 3 to 5 of the largest chains in that region. Okay. Which another great experience. Some of the customers were HEB, Corner Store, which was the Valero spinoff, Time Wise, Stripes, which was eventually acquired, I believe, by 7-Eleven, but down in Corpus Christi, Texas. So yeah, just helping them better understand the energy drink category, you know, what the trends were, what's working, where are consumers going. Just a super cool experience. And, you know, at Red Bull, I was super fortunate to have a couple of leaders that, you know, saw some potential in me on the sales side of things. Because I was going into so many of these meetings and seeing firsthand, you know, how each of the different sales folks at Red Bull sold, I soaked in a ton. So the opportunity was really to be a bit more of a one-stop shop for sales and category management. And I got to cover the great states of Mississippi, Arkansas, and West Tennessee.
Just slinging Red Bull.
slinging Red Bull. So an awesome, awesome area to cut your teeth. And it was funny, like the buyers knew it that I was calling on. They knew that was kind of a rotational area. So I would take a lot of grief from a lot of those buyers, like, oh, you're only going to be here for a year or a year and a half, and then we're going to get the next new person. So, you know, it made some of the meetings and sell-ins a little tougher, but, you know, a great, great area to really learn the business. And around that same time, you know, I started seeing a lot of these smaller, you know, upstart beverage companies, regional players, not necessarily national yet, start to pop up on the map. And they were a, you know, half share, one share, two share, but on a $1 billion category, you know, that's sizable dollars.
Yeah.
So I was just super interested in, you know, how are these smaller brands coming into the category and taking share and getting space on shelf. So I found an opportunity with IRI back up in Chicago, which is where I'm from. So my family was stoked that got me back home. But it allowed me to explore kind of this whole emerging and mid-market space. So I was calling on broom companies to cookie companies to energy drink companies and got to see, you know, a lot of the different business challenges that these folks had. And, you know, we're either trying to sell in to a retailer, we're trying to defend space in a retailer, we're trying to do better marketing, like you name it. There were a lot of different business challenges that they had. And, you know, soaked in a ton and learned a lot. Again, a great team over there. But ultimately, I missed the ownership of, you know, I would help a brand understand, you know, this is the type of data you should be using and bringing in to, you know, solve whatever problem you're trying to solve for. and then we'd hand it off and you never know what would happen.
Sure.
But what I did see is, you know, a lot of these emerging brands are dealing with very, very similar issues. So it was that time that, you know, RX Bar was starting to make their big push, and you know, saw an opening for a Midwest regional sales manager role with them, and was able to get that interview and come in with them. And as you mentioned, 2016, towards the tail end there, joined and just, I mean, you know, the RX Bar story from there. But it was an incredible opportunity because it was right before the real ramp up in sales volume, you know, going from 35 mil to 120 mil, which is just outrageous. Insane. On yeah. so many levels.
I remember even when I joined, I don't think I understood, because I came from Walmart. So like the numbers at RX Bar, I couldn't wrap my head around how big that was.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, now knowing so many brands, it's insane what we did.
It was the worst entry into startups you could have. I mean, it just wasn't real life and realistic. And like, it's such an anomaly compared to, you know, the day to day for so many emerging brands. And it's a total tip of the hat to, you know, Peter, Jared, Sam, Jesse, like the folks that were there early and really built it. Like,
yeah.
You know, you can say timing was big. You could say, you know, a lot of things, but man, they worked their butts off. They made a lot of really, really smart decisions at crucial moments. And, oh, I mean, it just wasn't real life.
It's crazy. No. Yeah. You've bounced around. It was funny looking through, I was just even glancing through your LinkedIn yesterday. How many different places you've been? Cause were you at Red Bull during some of their crazy growth times too? Like, I was looking back at those dates, yeah. And I couldn't remember if I felt like, from what I remember in research I could find, that you were there kind of in a crazy time too.
Yeah, it was 2012 through 2016 with them. And, you know, energy drinks got hit a little bit hard in the 2008 kind of financial crisis. And then coming out of that, it was just like high double digit growth year over year. And like, energy drinks to me are still such a fascinating category because they still post high double digit growth. Like, going back, do a historical look of Monster's stock price and take it back to like 2006. They were just unbelievable performance. And like, if I could have just invested in them.
Yeah.
Like, it's,
why do you
it's,
think it's that wild. Is? Like, were more people just giving it a chance? Like, 'cause I remember, I was in high school when energy drinks kind of came on the scene. And I don't remember even in high school people really drinking them very often. Like, it wasn't really a thing, at least the people I ran around with. It wasn't like all of us in high school were grabbing energy drinks. But then like college came around, and I feel like that was really popular for me. I was in college from the fall of 2010 through 2014.
Yeah,
and I remember by the end of that, it was, and then I know first year of working, I fucking pounded Monsters all day. Like, I was, I mean, so it's funny to think back to, because like, it must have just exploded in the like mid-teens.
Yeah, it, you know, they started, I think the first can was like 1987 or something like that in the US, or maybe it was 97.
Oh, but wow. So it's been around for a long time.
Yeah. But it started on that kind of on-premise or bar scene. And I think it was partly just, you know, the consumer adoption. You think about when a brand is entering in a consumer's life, and college is such a pivotal moment for all consumers and many consumers that are going to college, where you're kind of more open to experimentation and trying different things and new products. And you're also heavily influenced by your friends. And, you know, I think about the college scene, like Red Bull and vodka or, you know, Monsters for studying at the library. It was just easily accessible. And I think that entry point carried with that consumer base, through kind of your 20s and even into adulthood, like beyond 20s. Like, it's just like, as consumers have had their transition, like I think about my life stages and being a single guy, getting married, having kids, I love coffee, but I still like an energy drink every once in a while. Mm-hmm. I don't drink them as often as I used to. My frequency's down, but I'm still a consumer and still shop the category. So I think they brought a lot more consumers into the fold in kind of that 2010 to 2015, 2016. And consumers became a lot more comfortable with energy drinks at large. Like, if you recall back in the day, like there were a lot of studies and reports coming out that like energy drinks are really bad for you.
Right.
They were lost heart health
and all this shit. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And it's true with that. And, you know, anything else, moderation is key. Should you drink 4 16-ounce monsters that have a 200 milligrams of caffeine in a day? Probably not, you know?
Like, right.
But for a pick me up, like it serves its function. It serves its purpose.
It's interesting too, because you were at Red Bull, and correct me if I'm wrong, there wasn't a ton of competition in the category. Like, there were a few big players, but today there's unbelievable amounts of people that have entered that space. It reminds me of the bar space.
Oh, totally. Totally. It was, you know, Red Bull, Monster, Rockstar, NOS, which was a Coca-Cola company, if you remember that one.
Yeah. Is that still around? I'm sure it is. Just, I don't ever see it or hear about it. No.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
What a disgusting name for a drink.
I know. There is another one that I'm missing, but you really had five key players in that category. And then towards 2014, 2015, like Celsius was coming on the scene. Like, that's a brand that I remember back then, like starting to come in and eat up share. And we've obviously seen their kind of explosive growth. And then, to your point, entering Bang Energy and
Bang. Oh yeah.
Some of these other ones, it's a fascinating category that continues to grow double digits year over year.
That's wild. So Red Bull, that makes sense. And you were there too. I would call it a pivotal time when you joined RX. I don't think I've actually really had anyone on here that's been a part of the RX story. So you joined in 2016, man. 2016 was that to me, like, I missed the 2017 was nuts, but I came on towards the end of 2017. So I really came on like right around the acquisition. What was it like in 2016 being at RX during that time? Cause how many people were, do you know what number you were when you joined?
I think I was probably like 35 with them, 35, somewhere in there.
Okay. So I was like 55 or 60. So yeah, there, I feel like I was at the tail end of like the slow and steady hiring.
Yeah.
And it exploded, but wild. Yeah. So what was 2016 like when you came on?
It was no shortage of, you know, chaos. Like it was like many other startups that I've experienced since, where, you know, the company clearly had product market fit. The product was selling well. Retailers were really, really excited about it. So it was more so keeping up with demand. And, you know, I think about a shining star from that story, the supply chain team at RX, the best in the business. I mean, in 2017, we launched, I think 4 regions of Costco. This was all in the month of May. 4 regions of Costco, Target nationwide and Kroger nationwide. And somebody might want to fact check me, but it was those 3 in the same month at scale. And we did it without missing a beat. Like, the supply chain team,
which is crazy. Like,
unreal.
Thinking back on it and knowing brands now, like, that doesn't happen. Like, you get small regional plays and it slowly expands. Do you remember, like, how did we? Was it just we were crushing it everywhere else?
Yeah, so it goes back to, you know, you have a product that was serving a white space and meeting a need that was unmet in the category. So there was clear, like, we were solving a gap for retailers in the bar set. You had packaging that was so on point to consumers at that time and just dropped all the BS, and you saw what was right on the front of the package. And you think about like the leading up to 2016 and like when I came in, that team did such an incredible job on figuring out who to launch and when to launch with them to build the more of the data story around like our stats were like the number one velocity item, number one growth contributor. Like, we just had such strong stats to bring into all of our sales meetings. to, you know, gain placement, get additional facings. And like, we just had such a strong story and compelling story for retailers that you couldn't ignore it. And it was, you know, Haleo Whole 30, like it was just kind of sweeping across retailers. So a lot just aligned really, really well.
It was so weird because it's one of those classic stories. Like even when I came in a little after you, or a year later, really, like sitting in some of these retail meetings, or at least like I know I was a part of putting some of the decks together, putting insights together from a finance side, and then obviously your team did the actual market insights.
Yeah.
At the time, I didn't realize the unicorn we were a part of. And you think back to it now, and I know we both have worked with plenty of brands since RX Bar, and you just don't see that. Like everyone, there's some really cool, exciting products out there. Like there's some ones that I'm super bullish on that I work with, but yeah, it felt like every meeting at that time at RX, I'll never forget some of the, like, and this is nothing against them, but even going to a retailer like Lifetime Fitness, like flying up to Minneapolis, and it was just like, they're obsessed with us. It really was such a weird time to work at a CPG brand that was at that pivotal moment, because it seemed like every meeting we all had, like we'd all work really hard in putting the info together, but you'd walk in and it almost seemed like it was just selling itself. It was wild.
Yeah. And again, you think about values and culture of companies, everybody lived it. And I think one of the keys, like, you know, being easy to work with and being someone that, like, you know, a retailer or even external partner, like, looked forward to the call. Like, it was just folks that lived and breathed the brand, wanted the best for the company. And, you know, we didn't drop the ball much. Like, we didn't have a ton of supply chain issues. We had the one peanut recall at the end of, 2018.
Yeah.
But beyond that, like, you talk about a consistent partner that delivers, is selling like crazy. You have people that you want to work with and engage with. Like it just checked the box on so many levels.
Yeah, it did. And it's funny thinking back on that too. Because I hate this word, but people have asked me like, what was so special? And I say culture, but then I'm like, it's different than what you're thinking when I say that word.
Yeah,
I know when I was at Walmart.com and I was in Indianapolis, and then driving up to Chicago and doing the interview, like that final interview, or I think I sat down with Jim, Jesse, and then Peter to finish it. There was something about just like walking into that office. I don't know if it was like the age group too, just like a lot of young, fast moving, you know, business savvy folks that you just, there was something that it's almost impossible, I think, to replicate, because it was like the perfect, coolest product at the perfect time with the best people. Like it really was.
Yeah.
And that's like people that weren't there, it's hard to explain what it was like, but especially at 225, like before we made the big move to the big office, that small office, I only got to be there for 3 or 4 months, but yeah. That was wild. That was a time I would love to go back and work in that office again.
It was, you know, I hope to find myself in an experience like that again one day, but if I don't, like it's a highlight of a career type of situation, and just to be able to play a small role in that entire brand's growth trajectory, all of it. And I look back to the founders with Peter and Jared, and you know, they made such a push for hiring the right people, getting a structure and process in place, and more importantly, being able to back off and let the people that you brought in go do what they were hired to do. I think that's another piece that doesn't get looked on quite as often or quite as frequently, like what that had to take to kind of let loose of the reins and for Peter to move his focus from, you know, product in R&D, which I'm sure he still had a hand in, but he was so focused on people, hiring, and culture.
Oh yeah.
Like, at that point, like, I think that was really the driving force in creating like that buzz and energy in the office. Cause it was, you know, there was a model for folks that they were trying to hire with core values, skill set, and capabilities.
That's a really good point. I don't know if anyone's ever really said that, that I've heard publicly, because it's hard to explain that without talking to people that were there. But that's so true, because he really was. I mean, he was such a big advocate for all of us. And that's a funny thing. It's a funny way to phrase it, because I had never really thought about it. But thinking of all the people that came on around, even when I came on, it was like, we are doing, you know, process ABC, but we're bringing you on because we think you have an experience that you can bring to this and give us fresh eyes and actually like evolve it and like go figure it out. And it was a ton of that. I don't remember any team that felt like they were like overly managed. You kind of had the free willy to just like go figure stuff out, test it, break it, learn quick. That's so true across the board, across every function.
You had the support, and it was fail fast and learn and share, you know, what worked and what didn't. Like that,
I always think back to the thing that I've seen in other organizations since RX, but RX especially at that time, like 2017, 2018, there, you hit on it really well. There was which I think is a big differentiator for anyone who's, you know, starting a brand or working at a small startup today. There was just this, how do you explain it well? Every decision that was made, whether like it was Kyle and I on Amazon, or it was someone working on the Costco business or Kroger or whatever, the decision at the end of the day was always made on what's the best for RX Bar. It wasn't what was best for your role, what was best for your function or your team. It was always like, what's the best decision for RX Bar? And to your point, sometimes that was unfortunately like a hard decision, like something was actually made that would, for that team, it was like a big bummer or maybe like not aligned with what they wanted to achieve for that year, but it was better for the overall organization. Man, that's a tough one that you don't see replicated enough, where there's just like the siloed mentality. I always said that about RX for the longest time. There was just no silos, which is hard to do when you're scaling that fast.
And having the vast majority of folks in Chicago, I think made a big difference. I mean, I think about, you know, the early part of, especially the sales role that I was in when I first started, being able to walk over to Steve's desk, and Steve was supply chain lead for those folks that are listening, and be like, hey, I just got a request from Meijer and they're looking for a shipper program in 2 weeks. Can we execute on this? And him being able to give me an answer like that to go back to the buyer, be like, yeah, we can do it. What's your pre-commit? Like,
well, it's crazy. That's so cool. That was like, I got to see the tail end of that, but it was that office, like, just because it was, for everyone listening, it was one floor. So it was just everyone, there were rows of desks that we all slammed into because it was tiny. But you're right, you could just walk over and talk to any function in 2 seconds. And there was like really one big meeting room and then a few other smaller ones. So it was just, you could always get a sense of what was going on or what the emergencies were or opportunities. I mean, it was very easy to overhear things. Everyone was kind of looped in. Even when we changed offices and we went to the bigger office with multiple floors, you felt that immediately. Like when you have floor separation between functions, it created a totally different dynamic. That's really wild. I forgot all about that.
Yeah, that was a great, great office. That was a lot of fun.
225. I'll never forget. It's awesome. Well, cool. Well, yeah. So RX, that's a cool experience. And I mean, we could talk all day about RX. I'd love to know now though, for you. So now you're over at Numerator. Would you mind giving everyone a little bit of a background? I think, you know, I know my understanding of what data is available. I think for a lot of people listening, this is a really interesting area that you're obviously one of the best I know, and why I wanted to get you on here. Before RX, I know, just to give everyone a little background, I mean, I really didn't know what these data sources were. And if you're someone listening who is, you know, wanting to understand an industry, Mike here is going to be, I mean, honestly, like, he knows some of the best data sources and understands how to manipulate them and actually get meaningful takeaways. I'm teeing Mike up here because at RX Bar, this is what him and his team did. It was like, we'd have a question of what's going on in the market. They were able to not just get data, but like manipulate it and tell stories. Always what I explain. Like, you guys were amazing storytellers with data. So for anyone listening, I mean, when I came on, Nielsen and IRI, those were like the two. And then I remember Profitero, we worked with a little bit, which helped with e-commerce. So explain to everyone what Numerator is, how that works, how you guys get data. I would love to just give everyone like a quick 101 on how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for the kind words. You're far, far too kind. And it was a phenomenal team there that helped with a lot of that. It was not a solo mission for me. But Numerator is America's largest single source omni-channel panel. And what we do is, you know, we have a consumer facing app that we collect receipts from. So a consumer goes out, does their grocery shopping, takes a picture of the receipt on the app. The more receipts they upload, the more rewards that they get.
That's how that worked.
Yeah. So there's a clear one-to-one value exchange. And the process of gamifying it like that turns uploading receipts into a habit. So we have a very strong static panel. And when I say static, it means, you know, consistent uploads month over month, multiple trips, multiple retailers, so that you can start longitudinally seeing how consumer patterns are shifting over time. Mm. And more importantly, and this is where Numerator really, really stands apart and shines, we can connect one-to-one to e-commerce. So we can understand how someone, you know, may have started on Amazon and now where they're shopping brick and mortar, or as we saw with kind of COVID, you're on brick and mortar, you just shifted to Instacart. We're tracking Instacart as well. So we're collecting receipts. We link into the consumers on the app with their permission, of course, their Amazon account, Instacart, retailer loyalty. So we get, again, that full omni-channel view.
Whoa. And so when you connect to Amazon, when someone purchases on Amazon, that just like goes to Numerator, like the receipts kind of flow over to Numerator the same way automatically.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Cool. Oh, I didn't know
that.
When the
account's linked. So it's, you know, allows us to do a lot for our brands. And, you know, Numerator itself has been around for, I think this is the 11th year they launched in 2012. And that receipt technology in uploading receipts is, you know, very much a disruptor in the market research space. And this is where things get super fun and where we work with a lot of brands. Because we're collecting data at the receipt level, we have verified purchasers. So we know 2 days ago if somebody purchased Elite Sweets or Elite Donuts. And we can trigger a survey to that consumer to say, hey, what'd you think? Why'd you buy? What'd you think of pricing? If you did a reformulation, I know you mentioned that they're going into
shelf stable now.
Shelf stable. Yeah. What do you think of the new shelf stable product? So we can start understanding like very quickly, almost real time, why consumers are making the decisions that they are. So when you think about taking a step back, data at large, you have two main sources for CPG. You have point of sale data, which is what's going through the register. Think of your kind of Nielsen IRI spins. That's going to tell you what happened, what was purchased, you know, was it on promotion, things like that. Panel is really the why behind the buy. So you can understand like, you know, what consumers have only bought one time. And this is another area we do a ton of work on, you know, who are those one-time purchase consumers? Where do they shop? Where do they consume media? How do they buy? What do they look like demographically, psychographically, to then help inform, you know, marketing strategies and trying to convert those one-time buyers to 2, 3, 4-time buyers.
Oh, interesting. So you get that. And do you try to inform them? So if someone purchased one time and they're not purchasing again, are there methods that you guys are using to try to get them to try it again, whether it's like a discount or some sort of promotion?
Not through our platform. So we keep a very purist point of view where we do not want to bias consumer shopping decision making in any way, shape, or form. We want the purest form of consumer behavior possible. Now, what we can do is take those insights, give it to the brand marketing team and say, hey, your one-time buyers are 18 to 25-year-old males that over-index on TikTok cooking videos. Right. And then they can go start serving ads or partnering with influencers on TikTok cooking videos that over-index with that consumer base to start running tactics to get those buyers to come back into the fold for that brand.
Oh, love that. That's really cool. So then you work. So I get it. So you're trying to build the consumer facing side. Obviously that's where you're getting all the data inputs. And then on the back end, you work with brands because the brands then can obviously leverage the data sets to make smart decisions.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, we work with retailers as well. We work with Wall Street. We're actually, and this is a super interesting one, we're getting into more of the government space. You would be shocked at the level of data that the government has at you know, their disposal. I think when they're putting out, whether it's inflation reports or CPI, like that data is almost 6 months old by the time they're publishing the reports. And with our database, like we track all this on our own, and there's a lot of free resources on our website where we're trying to better inform, you know, the U.S. government on what's happening with consumer behavior. It's just it's a very cool time to be at Numerator. Yeah.
Well, because, yeah, what would the government do before a tool like Numerator? Like, where are they getting all this info?
I can't speak specifically to it because it's not a group that I sit in, but I think you have some syndicated data providers that are sending in data, but it's not real time. I think it's just a data dump that gets sent over and then manipulated by economists to come up with the reports and what they pump out. Yeah.
Whoa. Okay. Wild. So, you know, it's funny. One of the reasons that sparked wanting to get you on here was, which I love. I love it when people start posting like something that they're specifically interested in. And in my opinion, it starts kind of getting some virality. And for you to build off of what you just explained with Numerator, Mike started, for everyone listening, and I'll put a link to a recent one in the show notes. But Mike started posting essentially like category overviews on LinkedIn. So you like break down a category from the Numerator data and you'll explain kind of like the good and the bad of where this category is trending, which I personally get all nerded out on. I've loved your post, just so you know.
Thank you.
So for everyone listening, what are you excited about? Like, you're looking at all these data sets and you and I were going back and forth on LinkedIn a little bit. I'll tell you mine next, but do you have like a specific category that you're just like really fired up about? You know, we talk about RX and Red Bull and where those categories were going back in those days, but you were just at Expo too. Was there anything that stood out to you or looking at the data that kind of jumps off the screen as an area that's just exploding?
You know, it's what drew me to Numerator, and what I love about it is, you know, I've had a lot of brand experience and I've been fortunate in having the experiences I've had, the people I've worked with and the companies I've worked at, but it's typically been singularly focused to one brand in those challenges.
Right.
With Numerator, I get to work with multiple brands in the emerging to kind of mid-market size base. So it's a loaded question to ask for a favorite category, because there's a lot. Obviously, I posted on nutrition bars, which I'm a consumer of. I love hot sauce. So that's another one.
Oh, I saw that one. That was cool.
But I've gotten a lot of requests from other folks on categories to go into. I think one of the more interesting ones that's developing kind of right before our eyes is the disruption to carbonated soft drinks. And you think about prebiotic, probiotic sodas, your Olipops, your Poppies. They are coming in and making a significant push. And it's not a flash in the pan. Like, they are consistently growing households. As consumers become more aware, they try, they continue to buy. It's a category or a emerging category that, you know, I think has a ton of runway because, you know, you think flavor and functionality are two keys. Mm-hmm. The flavor is there. I think historically, like, yes, the category needed to be created by someone, but, you know, I think consumers, to get the functionality, were willing to sacrifice on taste. And I think this goes for a lot of categories at large. When you're going more of a functional product focus, they'll sacrifice on taste. But with a lot of these prebiotic and probiotic sodas, the taste is awesome.
Yeah, so it's really good.
And consumers are willing to pay a little bit more for it, which then becomes more appealing to retailers. And retailers start expanding space in the center store aisle. Maybe they give some beverage cooler on the perimeter. Like, it just affords more placements and positions for brands. So that's one I think is super cool and fun to look at on the data side because we're at the early stage. I mean, they've been around for two or three years or three or four years at this point. And that's just continuing to grow and grow.
It's really funny you hit on that one because literally in the last week, my wife has bought Olipop and Poppy. Like, and Poppy, she loves. I was pushing her because I actually had Dave from Olipop on here a long time ago, like probably 2 years ago. And they were definitely getting traction, but they've exploded since I talked to them. And it's funny because once you try them, I personally am like, why would I ever have a soda? Like, it just doesn't even make sense when you look at like what's in both. On the flip side, it's so much more expensive. So it's really interesting because that category to me, it seems like they're, I guess the same way protein bars kind of were when RX came out. But I always feel like when there's such a separation between what was the old and what is the new from a price point, you're inevitably going to have this, like you're going to have this subset of consumers that just can't afford the better one. But I guess over time, maybe those prices could come down a little bit, but I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, you obviously want to keep the premium price point as much as possible, but then you start getting into channel strategy. Like you're not going to have the same price at typically not at a Whole Foods as you will, you know, a Jewel Osco or, you know, Walmart, of course, or Costco. So the price will come down, but what I hope doesn't happen is, you know, the category, which I think we're a ways away from it happening, becoming a commodity. And then driving price down, which I don't, you know, it's good for the consumer, not great for the brands, especially when they're emerging in startup brands. But just a super, super cool space.
Definitely. And the one that I mentioned to you on LinkedIn, I don't know why, but I've become extremely bullish on this in the last, honestly, since Expo. And it's the non-alcoholic space. And there's two big reasons. One, at Expo, that was my takeaway. There were so many brands. So there's obviously a lot of folks that are seeing something. And there's like, it's funny. My takeaway at Expo was there's two parties that I noticed. One, brands that are trying to emulate what alcohol tastes like without the alcohol, which a couple I felt like got pretty close. And then the other side of the coin are brands that are saying, I don't want to taste like alcohol. We just want to be a cocktail experience, cocktail club, I think is what it was called, or mocktail club. I can't remember. That one I thought was impressive because it was like very well thought out in the kitchen where the flavors and taste came from. And then you go to we have a Jewel that's down the street here in Elmhurst, and just the cold aisle now. It is just, it's enormous. It's incredible how many brands are in that space that are all alcohol and how small the non-alcoholic space is.
Yeah.
And then I take a step back and I look at just the even millennial direction that people are going with pulling back on drinking with things like I've worn like a Whoop for a long time and I see that community. And that is the one thing that stands out to anyone that tracks with those types of tools is out of anything you put in your body, alcohol is probably the one that has the biggest effect.
Yeah.
And then I was reading this report the other day about Gen Z consumers, how Gen Z consumers that are in college today, and I can't remember the data source, so that's probably an important piece to this, but the report said 60% are now saying they binge drink less than our generation did in college, which is wild. Like they're all like smoking and just doing other things besides drinking. I don't know. That one excites me just because I feel like there is just it feels like the younger generation is just pivoting towards like not wanting to drink as much. So it seems like there's an opportunity, but
generational shifts. And again, this is what gets me stoked about like Numerator. We can see all of this happening and playing out real time. I mean, you nailed it with non-alc, like it's consumer driven by Gen Z. And, you know, it's now making its way, you know, into older generations that are questioning, you know, what is my relationship with alcohol, or, you know, maybe I don't want to drink as much, or I want to feel comfortable in a social setting and have a can in my hand, but I don't want it to be a beer. Yeah. I think taste has come a long way in that category where some of the stigma is gone. There's still stigma there, no doubt, but it's reducing over time and you have products that actually taste better. So it's like, enjoyable to drink, and it you don't feel like crap the next day. Like there's benefit on benefit on benefit, and to each their own. Do whatever you want to do out there. Right. But you are seeing a major shift happen real time. And again, what this means and the ripple effect that it has generationally, knowing that it's starting now with Gen Z, I mean, big impacts. And I would imagine there are many of alcohol brands that are figuring out and talking about, you know, what does this mean for us? And then I would think the mergers and acquisition space is going to heat up with more and more of these folks coming in.
If I was a betting man, if you look at a lot of the categories that you and I both play in, it generally seems like, and I could be totally wrong here, but you look at Kellogg or General Mills or the ones that we've been close to, and it's like, is there a product right now that I could see them acquiring? Like, I don't know. Like there's just not a lot of the growth in the profitability that there was in 2015, 2016, 2017, when some of those crazy, crazy numbers were being put up, and then the acquisition dollars that were getting put out. And then you look at, I feel like the alcohol space is one where there really hasn't been there's been some, but there hasn't been like massive acquisition. I don't know. Yeah. I think there's a huge white space there personally. It feels like exactly what you said. If there were some brands that came up and actually made a dent and actually saw some growth and had a profitable base, which is tough with canned goods, it seems like that could be a really juicy place for some of the major alcohol companies in the U.S. because just snatch some of those up and then they have, you know, a high growth non-alcoholic brand. And they, you know, same stories, RX and all these other ones that we talked about.
Totally, and it's a grind, especially for beverage. And you know, you got big alc brands that are probably not making it super easy to get a lot of space in stores. So, you know, I have nothing but respect and admiration for a lot of these early stage operators in this environment that are just grinding it out to, you know, see the next day and keep seeing the next day and build their business, you know, one store at a time. It's not easy, but it's doable. There are some proof points out there in the marketplace with strong brands gaining, you know, national presence and national reputations.
It seems like in beverage too, what's so interesting is there's some brands that have the regional approach that seem like they do well enough because they can kind of keep their distribution tight so they can keep profitability to some degree. And then it seems like there's no middle ground. Like you either have to do that and then go national almost and like have a big distribution deal. There's not a whole lot of people in the middle, right? Or they burn out in the middle. Because it's just so expensive and tough, it seems like.
I think it's the one thing that, you know, I appreciate, you know, the folks that talk about it openly on LinkedIn. It takes a lot of money to start a CPG business and
it's crazy.
Make sure it goes there. Again, going back to the RX bar, you know, unicorn in every sense of the word, like that's not the norm. And with the shift now to companies, you know, favoring profitability over top line growth, like that only reinforces further on, you know, being really, really smart with how you're spending your dollars. And, you know, folks are running out of runway and it is a tough environment currently.
I know that's been something funny on my side of the fence is that's something that we've always tried to do since we started Noble was just, we have this profitability approach to everything we do. I mean, I think it's one avenue that no matter what the economy is doing, it's just so important to know, right? It's so important to have a good understanding of your channels. It's crazy in the last 8 to 9 months, how much of a pivot I see brands are going through of where it was just grow top line at all costs to now it's like, how do we have profitability? It's everything now. So it'd be interesting. I feel like in your space with innovation in categories that are growing, because inevitably what that has to mean is, some brands aren't going to make it, right? Which then questions like how fast some of these categories grow. Are you seeing anything like that? Like, are there any categories where not necessarily you see writing on the wall that brands are going to go out of business, but we talk about categories growing. Are there any that you think are shrinking that like there's better for you products that you and I are both interested in, but inevitably like it's just a tough category through this time that you might see you think will shrink over the next year or two?
Yeah, it's a tough one to answer. Like I would have to go run some numbers. So I can only speak, you know, anecdotally and just kind of my gut and what I've kind of seen and experienced. You know, when you're looking at the category level, like we're talking about like think beverages, think cookies, candies, like those are large categories. So the buying behavior will be there. It's when you go a step lower into subcategories where you start to see some of the shrinking and expanding. And then of course, when you go brand level, I think very much like it's going to come at the expense of big companies. I think you have a lot of disruption happening from these emerging brands that are delivering or extending a usage occasion for, you know, think a protein bar. You typically have it pre-post workout or in the middle of the day, like a breakfast occasion or a dessert occasion, like finding additional ways to extend the usage of a product. And I think those will start coming at the expense of kind of the more legacy brands in the category. I know that's not a great answer to your question, but you know, I think there aren't any categories that are going away anytime soon. I think you have a lot of early stage brands that are blurring the lines of categories, and extending those use cases that are probably taking some of the trips and the purchases away from your more long-standing brands on shelf.
Got it. No, I think that's a good answer. I mean, what's interesting to me, and I saw this at Expo, it seems like I remember towards the end of RX, there was a big debate internally before I left. This was probably 2018 into 2019. I remember talking to Jim about this. Keto. Exactly. Yeah. Just like having this conversation of, is it something that's going to stick or not? Do you have any perspectives on that? Because I find that so interesting, where like paleo was one of the things we jumped on at RX. It's still around, but I don't hear anybody ever be like, oh, I'm paleo. That's not something people maybe eat that way, but I don't hear people. It's not this like loud and proud thing that people are slapping on their Instagram. You know what I mean? But
it's
keto for sure is. People want to say they're keto all the time.
It's so funny that you bring that up. I remember that time vividly at RX. Because everybody, I don't know if you'll remember the chart that I'm about to explain, but everybody was showing the Google Trends chart of.
Oh, I remember this.
Like keto.
Didn't
keto
you or Pierce? Searches. You or Pierce, someone found this and was showing.
Yeah. So you know, keto is an interesting one. And this is my personal opinion. This isn't, I don't have data tied to this yet. I think keto is probably wound down from where it was. I think there's a core consumer base, but that core consumer base, I don't think can carry the category at large to, you know, the heights of a paleo or some of the other diet trends. I think at large, you look at a company like Atkins. Atkins is like sneaky strong every single year. And you think like, why does Atkins do well? Yes, there's the Atkins diet, but in general, they're, you know, low sugar, lower carb. They kind of fit all like diet fads. Like they just hit on whether right, wrong, or indifferent, if that's actually good for a consumer or not, you know,
right,
up for debate. But they appeal to your everyday consumer of, hey, you know, I want less sugar, I want less carbs. This is appealing to me and it tastes good enough. Again, I think that's when it's function or dieting, it just needs to taste good enough. So for me, keto, I think brands have been or are in the process likely of pivoting away from, you know, having that as the main kind of call to action for a consumer on packaging. Okay. And I think they revert back to a, you know, sugar call out or protein call out and just keep it basic for consumers. Cause I think consumers are starting to become smarter and smarter about, you know, what should I be looking for on a package. But in general, you know, I think it's part of why keto didn't take off as much as I think everybody would have thought it did, because I still don't know exactly what goes into keto. I think your everyday consumer, there's a lot of education that goes in, and it can be intimidating to jump in and make that great of a lifestyle change.
Definitely. Oh yeah. I mean, I totally agree. What I find funny when I think about any of these trends, and not to keep going back to RX, but it was like, you know, this paleo CrossFit subgroup, but then the everyday mom was also aligned with what was in that. So it just like it bridged this gap from super special to general public. And
yeah,
not everyone, but a lot. There's a huge swath of people. And I'll never forget. And I think you were there during this. Were you there when Steve I can never pronounce his last name. The CEO of Kellogg.
Yes.
When he came to the office, do you remember the question Connor Patterson asked? I don't know why this sits in my brain to this day. I think it was Connor. Connor made a comment around like, you know, where does Steve and where does Kellogg think, you know, the future of a lot of their categories and products are going, knowing, you know, like we're in this crazy growth mode and a lot of theirs are flatlining. Something along those lines, basically saying like, you know, we're obviously growing really fast and a lot of your products are kind of dying, for lack of better words, right? They're slowing down. Yeah. And I'll never forget Steve just kind of chuckled. Because I think all of us thought the same thing. All of us were like, why? No offense. Like, why is Steve? This is going to sound condescending, but like we were all like fired up young professionals growing a better for you product. And, you know, he's growing Kellogg, which has a ton of products that none of us aligned with. And he responded with, you know, if you want to get a good sense of what Americans are eating, you don't look in Chicago. Don't look at L.A. Don't look in New York. Go to an Oklahoma Walmart and park your ass in a parking lot. And look at the average consumer's shopping cart that walks out of that place. I'm telling you, it's not RX bars.
Yes.
And he just stopped and said that. And I was like, it's so true. Like most of America is not where we all live. It's not in these big cities where we're going to Whole Foods. It's the general consumer that's probably going to Walmart. And so if you want to be a brand that's going to sell someday, like you can't just be good at this small niche. You can start there for sure, and you can get a really loyal following behind that, but it's also got to kind of spill over into general America to some degree
for sure,
and be a product that, to your point, isn't scary or unknown of what's in it to the general consumer. It's such an interesting it's a lot of brands haven't figured out how to like do both or like spill over, I don't believe.
Yeah, and that's where you think about, like, again, going back to, you know, emerging and building brands, like your launch strategy and timeline and who you're going with when truly matters. And, you know, I think you're seeing your Walmarts, your Targets get a lot more active on trying to bring in new and emerging brands. But you have to be really smart with how you approach those, because to your point exactly with that story in Oklahoma, Target or Walmart isn't the same as an LA Target or Walmart. So, you know, finding ways to make sure you're cherry picking and going into the stores where you're going to be as successful as possible to help build and drive that awareness. But I think the second point of that is, you know, there is something to having a product that a general consumer can understand. Like, RX's packaging did a phenomenal job. If you would have done a survey and said, you know, does a product called RX bar appeal to you, and said nothing else, they'd be like, no, I don't know what that is. But then when you show a picture of the packaging, that tells you everything you need to know. It was just so upfront. So I look at like other brands, and, you know, Midday is another great example. Mm-hmm. You know, it's functional chocolate, but at the end of the day, it's chocolate. Consumers understand chocolate. I think it was one of the really, really smart things that, you know, they did over there, is they took a product that consumers can easily understand and made a phenomenal product out of it. And then they just add in the protein and the fiber to get the functional aspect. Right. I think more and more in categories, there has to be that understanding from the consumer, the general, you know, run of the mill US consumer, to know, like, you know, this doesn't intimidate me to try it. Like, it's just chocolate, or it's just a protein bar. Because I think with a lot of the brands coming out in the natural space, you're using very unique ingredients and items, which works great for natural, but probably not going to work as good in a Hy-Vee, a Jewel-Osco, a Walmart in Oklahoma.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. That is a really good point. And Midday is a good example of that. I'm curious to see if that becomes a bigger trend. And it's funny, when you said that, the first thing I thought of is Peter would always say that. If someone, I remember he mentioned this one time, just like someone asked what he did, he's like, I just sell protein bars. Like, just dumbing your product down to a point of like, everyone knows what a protein bar is, but then you see ours. And it's funny too, even thinking, you're right. Cause if you ask someone, if just saying RX bar, 99 out of 100 people wouldn't know that had anything to do with a CrossFit RX workout. Like that had, that would never have come, you know, to most people. That's such a true point. The packaging did so much. It's funny too, since then, how many brands I feel like have tried to kind of even copy what RX did. And it's, man, I don't know. To me, it bums me out. Cause I'm like, I wish there was a more innovative way brands could try to do what they replicated at that time, but to do it in their own way. A funny example, not to call out a brand, but there's a bar called True Bar that my wife just picked up at Costco. Literally, it's True Bar and the exact same, it's not the same font, but it's really close. It's black and white. And then they use like really bright pink and green packaging. And it's basically just like, it's basically RX's plant bar, but actually it tastes worse. It sucks. It's like vegan plant-based pea protein. But it just reminded me, it was, you know, they say no bad stuff on it. It's just like, come on, just do it. But they're in Costco. Got to give them credit. I mean, they're they're doing something. But yeah, the innovation side, I hope we see more brands try to bridge that gap.
Totally. And, you know, you think about the way that that package came to life. It was, you know, Peter, Jared, Sam, Jesse going to CrossFit events and selling the bar. And they would talk about, you know, when somebody asked, what is this? They would explain, you know, it's just a couple of dates, egg whites for protein. Like it was on the back of the old packaging, and they found themselves like flipping the packaging over and going through it. And then that was like the inspiration that, you know, they gave to the packaging firm that they worked with and how they got to it. But it's simple stuff like that. Like you need to know the consumer. It has to be at the heart of everything. And that doesn't get unlocked unless you're having those conversations or you're in touch with the consumer and know, you know, what about your product is working for them and why are they using it and why does it make sense to be able to unlock things like that to help with that mass appeal and how you make that next jump. Cause you're going to have a niche to start, but you're going to have to grow your consumer base if you want to get to the next level in terms of sales, whether that be 5 mil, 10 mil, 50 mil, 100, whatever it may be. There are always going to be consumer cohorts that you're not tapping into that you have to understand to make those jumps.
Right. You do. And that's wild. It's funny because the thing that just came to mind as you said that is I wonder if we're going to see a little bit of a pullback in that behavior, because that's so true. They were literally at CrossFit events talking to CrossFit athletes, getting that type of feedback. And when COVID happened, so much went remote. I wonder if that just inevitably is something that new brands now, it's an uphill battle because they're probably not boots on the ground as much as folks were back in 2014, 15, 16, 17.
For sure. But I think that pendulum is going to swing back because you have to be. I still think that's really the only way that you can actually, you know, build a business or an effective way to build a business is you win in your own backyard as a brand. And you're boots on the ground, you're at events, you're at your local grocers, like wherever you're getting placement. Once you win, I think you stage gated at that point. Like what's the next most similar region we can go into? Cause again, you want to cherry pick success along the way. Where are you going to do the best to then build that momentum and help that story for the next retailer that you pitch or whatever it may be. But it all comes back to the consumer. So I think, you know, I always look forward to demos when I go and shop and I'm in stores. So it feels like they're coming back more and more. And, you know, having two young kids, I can't say I'm going to Coachella or Lollapalooza. So I don't know what the sampling activities are there. But I feel like brands should be making an effort at those locations because it's awareness and you're tapping into people when they're going into an experience where they're looking to try something new and can be easily influenced. And that's a shout out to Dr. Dreams Richardson, which it's one of his main focus points in his Ramping Your Brand book. It's effective. Consumers are looking to be influenced there and having an effective field marketing strategy to meet them at that place and in an authentic way be influenced to try the product is pretty big impact.
Oh, that's cool. I'll have to read that book. I'm gonna add that to my list. I have not read
it's a great one. Really good.
Awesome. Well, to get into the, we're getting to the end of time here. So I have three questions that I always ask every guest. So the first one, and if you want to use that one, you can, but if you want, if you have another one, I'd love to hear it. The first question is source of knowledge that you'd want to share with the audience today. So whether it's a book, whether it's a podcast you've listened to recently, you know, an article, anything like that, that really like comes to mind right away that the audience should know about.
There's two. Can I go with two or do I have to pick one?
Of course. Yeah, no, throw them out.
All right. So the first one, I'm not going to use the one that I just shared because that one's still good, but Breakthrough Brands by Jared Schreiber is another one where he's actually one of the co-founders of Numerator, which was formerly Info Scout, but he basically takes, you know, a look from 2016 to 2019 on the top, he takes each category, top winning brands from that category and a losing brand from that category, and talks about what separates the winners from the losers. Think good to great.
Wow. Yeah.
But for CPG brands, awesome read. Super interesting.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's that one. And then on a personal level, the boy, the mole, the fox, and the horse, is the second book. And this is more of a personal, just kind of life, good message, good sentiment, really, really good book. It was given to us as a gift for our daughter, but I was so unbelievably touched by the book. And I don't know if I'm getting soft as a dad or whatever it may be, but it was okay. Awesome. Yeah. Love that one. So highly recommend that one too.
Love it. Okay. I will, I'll have to check both those out. I'm putting together quite the book list. Like every time I talk to someone, I get really good books and like neither of those were on there. They're always new. And now my list is getting so long. I'm like, I don't know how we're going to dig out, but that's a good problem to have. Someday when I'm old and retired, hopefully I can just finish all these awesome books.
There you go.
That's a great one, Mike. The next question is one of my favorites. This is actually a new one. So this is a new question that I've wanted to ask. So you'd be a good one. So you've obviously had quite the career already. Is there anything for everyone listening that you would say at this point in your career has been a regret or just a huge opportunity that you've learned from that you want to take into the next part of your, like the, basically the next half of your career, as a young professional?
Oh, that is a great question. I can't say it's necessarily a regret. But it's definitely something to take further into my career, but it's saying yes more often, and not being scared of what the challenge may be or what other people's perceptions of your own personal decision to make whatever that decision may be, not letting that hold you back. I think getting more uncomfortable in, hey, I might not, whether it's role related or learning something new, you know, am I a perfect fit for this role? Maybe not, but say yes to it, try it, see if it works. I think a lot of growth, at least I've seen so far, has been at the times where I've taken a risk and said yes, even when maybe I didn't think I was fully qualified to go do the job. And you don't know that until you say yes. And you know what, if it doesn't work out and you fail, so what? Dust yourself up and get back out there.
That's a really good one, man. I just had a conversation with someone the other day because I was looking back, I'm 31, and I realized that right when I got out of college, I really started getting into the weeds of investing. So I've been in that game for 10 years, like actually putting money towards stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, I've been doing it for 10 years, which feels crazy. That's already, it's crazy to think I've been out of college that long. And I was like, I should take more risks. Like back then I was like, oh, I got to make sure you're being smart. Like don't take too big a risk. And you're like,
yeah,
I could have taken so many more risks in my career, invest it. Like it's a good one, Mike. That is a good one. Cause you don't realize how much time you have, you know, hopefully.
And it's the Chinese proverb, the best day to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best day is today. Like,
hell yeah.
You love just got to go do it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really good. Appreciate that. Hopefully everyone loved that one and can take something from that. The last question, and this one I'm a nerd about, so I love asking this one because all the smart people I have on here that are way smarter than me have way better ideas. But what tools do you use to get shit done on a daily basis, but also to achieve the goals you have, whether it's life, career? Like, do you have, are you a pen and paper kind of guy? Do you use apps? Like, what do you use to just kind of like map out and get your shit done?
Panda Planner is
Panda Planner. I've heard of this one.
Is my biggest one. That has fundamentally changed how I just approach my day, week, month, year. It's a basically a pen and paper notebook where you go out and plan your week ahead. I do it on a Sunday. Every morning I start off planning my day from, you know, what are my three, you start with what are you grateful for, which is always a great way to start the day. Top three priorities, tasks that need to be done. I've adapted it a little bit to fit my need. I've been doing it for probably 2 years now. But it's just the best way for me to focus and make sure I'm spending my time against the highest value and highest impact areas, and just a way to cut out some of the noise and clutter. Cause you get the whole quadrant of like important and urgent, and making sure I'm in that important and urgent and not doing stuff that, you know, just isn't a priority.
I love that. I use something similar. It's called the Full Focus Planner. If you're in one of those, it probably you get ads for all of them. Same exact thing though. Like your big three for the day, you have a weekly view where you sit down on a Sunday and map it out.
Yep.
I should be a salesperson, or they should be a sponsor of this podcast by now, because I give them way too many free plugs. But it's funny because, you know, there's so many apps out there and everyone loves the apps because you can capture everything. But if you just get I know one other person that loves those Panda Planners for full focus. It's funny, on my shelf that no one can see, I have it. I started it right before Kyle and I started working on Noble, and I've had a notebook every quarter since. And it's funny, you can like, I read through it all the time. I'm like, you can see how like I never used one of those before. And that's how you can like start something or like get something off the ground, is just like using one of those planners. It really gets you to stop and think about what's important. I'm a diehard in those.
Totally. Yeah. That's the biggest one for me, at least the one that immediately comes to mind.
I love it. That's awesome, Mike. Well, cool, man. Well, can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast. I know it was some short notice.
Thank you for having me. This is great. This has been awesome. Love your stuff. You've had some terrific guests, and
thanks, man.
You're even better to talk to on the podcast, not just listen to.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. It's funny, you know. I someone just asked me the other day. They're like, "What's your end goal with the podcast?" And I was like, "It's growing. It's consistently grown. I don't have an end goal, to be honest with you. People talk about hobbies. Like, this is one of my favorite hobbies I have. I get to talk to cool people like you, and like, how often do you get to sit down with, even for an hour, and just talk about stuff like this? Like, even if you're in an office, like, you don't get to sit down for an hour and actually like focus one-on-one and talk to somebody. So
totally.
It's awesome. Yeah. You know, what's funny, and I say this way too often too, but you really should, you would have a great podcast. You got a great podcast for you. You have really cool information. Like, it'd be cool for you to have people on in the industry and just talk about, you know, categories and different growth mechanisms. I think it'd be sweet.
Yeah, well, I don't know how you're doing it with a newborn at your place and the job.
I need thank to my wife.
I got to figure out the time management aspect, but I appreciate that. Thank you.
The key is you don't sleep. Yeah, you just keep going. I don't really sleep a lot. I just work and do podcasts all day.
Awesome.
Oh man. All right, Mike. Well, thanks so much, buddy. I will. I'll let you know when this is up and live, and I can't thank you enough. As always, everyone listening, I'll add show notes to get to Mike to learn more about Numerator, all the stuff he talked about. This was awesome, man. I appreciate it.
Of course, man. Keep crushing it, dude. Great chatting with you. And thanks again for having me on.